Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that people do not lose their faith because of science, or only a tiny minority do. That used to be the argument. It really isn't the case. It's empirically, it has been shown not to be the case. People did not lose their faith in the 19th and 20th centuries because of the coercion of science, and they're not going to in the future. So in a sense, there's nothing to explain there. Different countries have become more secular, more non-religious, sometimes more anti-religious for quite specific reasons. Those reasons are almost always political and social and cultural. Science feeds into that, but we're looking at the wrong thing altogether if we're searching for science as the root of secularisation. It doesn't work like that.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtime, en podcast fra Tankesmien Civitan.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and today I'm joined by Nick Spencer. He is a senior fellow at the Theos think tank in the UK. Nick and I have talked a year ago about liberal democracies, and today our topic is Nick's new book, Magisteria, The Entangled Histories of Science and Religion. And in my view, this book is a tour de force in the history of ideas. So congratulations and welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be here.
What made you really embark on such an ambitious project? It's tracing the history from antiquity to artificial intelligence, and that's both in scope, time scope, and also in all the things that you are talking about. It's a huge project.
It is, yes. I've had a long-standing interest in science and religion, but I guess my first proper excursion into it was about 15 years ago now, during the 2009 Charles Darwin anniversary, 200 years since his birth, 150 years since the publication of The Origin of Species. And for that, I did quite a lot of research, but I also wrote a short book on Darwin's own religious journey, which struck me as very interesting, very subtle, quite complicated, much more interesting than the rather simplistic picture we'd sometimes got about that, and indeed the somewhat simplistic picture we sometimes got about the relationship between religion in general and scientific development in general. And I didn't do much about it until 10 or so years later when I returned to science and religion, and I'd read an awful lot in the intervening time, and it struck me that there was a huge amount of academic research in this area, and the whole field had come on a very long way in the last generation or so. But remarkably, there was nothing in a popular sphere. There was no serious trade press book on the history of science and religion, and I thought there should be, so I wrote one.
Indeed you did. Did anything surprise you in your research for this book?
Well, sort of yes and no, I suppose, is the answer to that. No, in terms of a big picture, partly because I've been researching into this area for a long time. There was nothing I came across that radically changed my understanding or opinion of what I was writing about. There were certainly lots of little example. So I'll just take one completely out of nowhere, really. The 19th century was the period in which there was greatest tension between science and religion, and there were various complex reasons for that we might come on to. But people naturally fixate on Darwin and the Origin of Species as the key point of that. In actual fact, far more controversial, far better selling, was a book published about 30 years before Darwin's Origin of Species called The Constitution of Man, which evangelical believers in particular despised. Now, from a long way, this looks like a classic story of science developing an understanding of humankind and religious believers rebelling against it, except for the fact that the book in question was on the science of phrenology, the idea that you could read someone's character from their skull bumps. And therefore, the religious objection to this had rather more to it than the subsequent religious objection to the Origin of Species. And the whole history of science religion is littered with little examples of surprises like that, which overall change the big picture that many people have of straightforward opposition between the two.
Because as you just say now, it's that although the broad picture might be well known even to people who haven't studied history. What you say is actually, won't say the devil is in the details, but it's nuances, and the devil is probably not. It can
no,
be.
No, that's right.
Though, but it's. But anyway, that when you go into details like you do, you find that there are so many more interesting things to say about different things happening during history, and I guess that's something that might have intrigued you and might have caught your interest in doing this.
Yes, it is. I mean, another little sort of detail, except the fact it's, in terms of chronology, much bigger than the detail. The phrase medieval science is often interpreted as an oxymoron. They didn't do science in the Middle Ages. That was precisely what made them medieval. It's a nonsense, really. They hadn't had what we would call, and I put this in heavily inverted commas, the scientific revolution at that stage, but that's a very complex phrase and we might explore that at another point. But the idea that medieval thinkers didn't approach the analysis of the natural world with naturalistic assumptions is a nonsense. They did, and sometimes they did so with great sophistication. So I'm not the first by any means to be retelling the story of science in the Middle Ages. But it's another one of those examples whereby what you thought you knew wasn't actually the case.
Hmm. The core arguments of your book boils down to the struggle about what it is to be human and, of course, who has the authority to define what it is. I know it's a huge question, but how has this changed throughout history, if you could kind of outline a broad development of this this question? We might just also break it into two periods if you wish.
Yes. Well, I mean, it is a huge question, and therefore any answer is going to be a bit of a generalization. But up until the 19th century, perhaps the 18th century in France, the assumption was that humans were spiritual beings. That didn't mean they weren't material beings. There were different opinions on that, of course, about how important that materiality was. But there was broad consensus around the generic fact that human beings were in some way spiritual. Scientific developments from the mid-18th century in France, through biology in particular, and then the 19th century, began to try and understand humans in wholly naturalistic terms as the kind of beings that had no soul, had no spiritual identity, had nothing other than a material, mortal existence. Small caveat here, there were plenty of people who had voiced that opinion about humans beforehand. You sometimes read about them in church courts in the Middle Ages. But it was an opinion. It was a reaction. It was sometimes a philosophical assertion. It didn't try and claim the mantle of science, or as it was known at the time, as natural philosophy, to defend it. And the reason why the 19th century is this period of tension between science and religion, not wholesale tension, but there is tension there, is that the right to adjudicate on the nature of the human was tussled over in that period. And in one sense, it's still being tussled over. Humans are endlessly fascinating, multi-dimensional creatures, and there's always going to be some tension around who gets to adjudicate on what kind of creatures we are. But the transition was in the 19th century, and that's why we have some of the great tension points, the famous tension points that we do in the 19th century. It was because of an attempt to try and understand humans in wholly and exclusively naturalistic terms.
Hmm. And then, of course, before that, religions had a lot to say. If we can say religion, we mean the Catholic Church or Christianity or whatever, being the authority defining, as you just said, the spirituality of human beings. And that was not the case, or it was gradually not the case throughout the 19th century, even a bit before that.
It's important also to make a really key definitional point here. The terms that we use as science and religion have been used in their own way for many centuries, but they only settled down to something like their established modern meanings around the middle of the 19th century. Beforehand, scientists in the Anglophone world were natural philosophers. Actually, there were lots of other words for them, but they were natural philosophers. They were conducting philosophy about nature. And that was done with the presuppositions of, on the foundations of, with the blessing of Christian or religious doctrine. So the idea that there were two such things as religion and science simply wouldn't have made sense to anybody, say, of Isaac Newton's generation. They were different intellectual approaches, but based on the same set of presuppositions and indeed the same set of beliefs.
So we actually have three terms that I've noted down: religion, of course, and then science, as you just tried to explain, and then secularism. So maybe we could take those three and go into what those terms are, how they came into being, and of course that they have changed somewhat in the meaning from any place in history until the modern use that we are using today.
Yeah. So there's a long history behind all of them, but very briefly, religion comes from religio, Latin meaning to bind. In the Middle Ages, it was a virtue, effectively, one of the virtues that one practiced, like a bit like fidelity or piety. In the period of the Reformation, it came to be understood as a set of doctrines for each of the different Christian denominations that spread across Europe. So there would be a Protestant religio, if you like, a Catholic religio or a Reformed religio, whatever else. And then as the European countries began to discover other worldviews and cultures, which to their mind looked a bit like the kind of Christian religios that they had been familiar with in Europe, they appropriated that term to describe what they discovered in South Asia or Southeast Asia or whatever else. So you had Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism, all of which are terms that are coined in the 19th century. And so the word is appropriated and used to describe a coherent and often allegedly narrowly doctrinal set of statements that represent a religion. Of course, none of these entities or worldviews were actually like that, but they became religions and understood through the lens of religion, and they still are today. Science effectively means knowledge. It was a form of intellectual, logical practice in the Middle Ages, but the activity that was used, that became science, was more usually described as natural philosophy. And it was only really in the late 18th century that science became hardened as a form of knowing about reality that was separate from natural philosophy with all its presuppositions. And it's only in the 1830s that the word scientist was coined in English, and only really by about 1850, 1860 that the scientist, as the practitioner of science, became authoritative. Beforehand, science wasn't really a single thing. It was a set of separate disciplines that coalesced under this rubric of knowledge, or reliable knowledge, or a reliable way of knowing about the world. Secularism is another one altogether. Sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. Just continue.
Secularism comes again from the Latin, meaning effectively this age. It was used by early Christians to denote that time between the ascension of Christ, the incarnation, the ascension of Christ, and the second coming, which was a period of time in which, again, simplifying enormously, Christians were mandated to respect political authority, but not to worship it. And so a secular authority became a kind of authority on this planet, which was an authority, which was respectable, but couldn't accrue to itself the authority of God. So, for example, in the Middle Ages, you had secular priests and religious priests. The religious ones lived in a religious order in monasteries, looking forward to the age to come. A secular priest would live in amongst his flock and minister to them in this age. And it was that idea of secularism that was then picked up by anti-religious campaigners from the 17th, 18th century onwards, and used to mean against the age to come, against the religious future, and therefore against religion.
So let's go back to the Middle Ages, and well, even a bit before that. It depends on one how we define the Middle Ages. But let's look at the story of Islam and science, because I think that story is interesting. And of course, maybe people would have heard about something called the Golden Age, which is something that's usually applied to Islam in a certain period. And you can also try to explain why science didn't keep its position in Muslim domains, as you explain in your book.
This is a huge and also very contentious topic. And I'm conscious that anything I say, you could raise counter-arguments against it. Very briefly, when the Umayyad Caliphate fell in the 8th century, the centre of the Islamic world passed to the Abbasid Caliphate near the area of Baghdad, I guess you would say. This was very much at an intellectual crossroads, and a number of caliphs subsequently sponsored very significant translation enterprises in which more or less the entirety of the scientific, in inverted commas, knowledge of the classical world, Greek science, effectively, which hadn't really progressed very much in the last 500 years, to be honest with you, was translated into Arabic, often by Syriac Christian scholars, and then appropriated into an Islamic worldview, and then built on by Islamic philosophers. And for a period of somewhere between, say, 800 AD and 1150 or 1200 AD, there is significant development and progress, scientific development and progress in the Islamic world. There are different opinions on this. Critics say it's basically Greek science that was, so to speak, as it were, baptized by Islamic theology. Others point out that actually not only was there a significant movement of translation there, but Islamic scholars genuinely did build on and even conduct original research on science, and therefore it is perfectly legitimate to call it Islamic research. And then there is this enormous question, well, if the Islamic world was so much more scientifically sophisticated in 1150 than the European world, why didn't it go on to develop a scientific revolution? There are lots of different answers.
That's the key question, of course.
That's a very key question. Often, because the question of Islam and science is so politicized, people read their own views of Islam into this question. So if your view is, well, the science was never Islamic in the first instance, the argument is, well, as soon as the wellspring of Greek ancient science dried up, of course there was no more progress. I don't think that counts, because that doesn't chronologically doesn't make any sense. There is a strong argument. There was a reaction against Greek science on the basis of Islamic theology, which effectively denied naturalistic causation. In other words, the belief was that if something happened, it's happened because Allah made it happen, which denied the fact that A causes B causes C in the natural world. And if you do that, you remove the whole infrastructure, the whole intellectual basis of science, and therefore you can't do any more science. I think there's something in that argument, but it's overplayed. There is another very important point, is that there are still a huge number of manuscripts written in Arabic and other languages of Islamic empires at the time that haven't been translated from the 12th century through to the 15th. And so there's a good argument that we don't actually know how much more developed it got. But there is something about Islamic theology, or particularly the philosophy of Al-Ghazali, who was the most influential theologian at the time, putting some resistance to the autonomous development of science at the time. There is altogether another argument as well, which was that, what I kind of make in the book, was that science is inherently a threatening activity because it, as it were, always goes where the evidence leads it, or at least it should do. That means authorities are naturally anxious about science, and they have been right down to the Soviet authorities in the 20th century. Science needed a protected intellectual environment in which to conduct itself, and universities in Europe developed that and they didn't exist elsewhere in the world, in China or indeed in India or in the Islamic world. And it's therefore because science or natural philosophy was enabled, was protected, as it were, within the walls of the university, that it was able to flourish in the Middle Ages. Again, there's something to that idea, but there are complexities within that even.
Mm. Yeah, I thought that was interesting because, as you said, this period of about 350, 400 years approximately, if you say, until, well, 1200, something like that, it just also coincide with the with universities in Europe, and it has something to it because then you're actually saying that institutions might also play a quite important role here to develop science.
So there is a very strong argument that it's down to institutions, and you can give an example for this. I'll follow up with an important counterexample. In 1277, the Bishop of Paris got very cross about Aristotelian teaching in Paris. He wasn't the first person to do so, but he issued a list of propositions that may not be taught in the philosophy faculty in Paris. There's a story here which is effectively it was a battle between the theology faculty and the philosophy faculty, but we can park that. The point I want to make is that in theory, that should have just closed down scientific or Aristotelian thoughts and argumentation. But of course, it didn't close it down in France because there were other nascent universities that weren't affected by the Parisian ban. And even in Paris, it wasn't hugely effective. Academic autonomy is never all it's cracked up to be, and it wasn't in the 13th century. But nonetheless, it was not possible for even someone as powerful as the Bishop of Paris to close everything down. So there's an argument there that universities did do quite a protective nature. But the flip side is that when the scientific revolution, again in inverted commas, gets going in the 17th century in Europe, it's not really a university-based thing. That a lot of the early people who were influential in science, say Francis Bacon in particular, an English statesman and philosopher at the beginning of the 17th century, is tearing his hair out because his university experience at Oxford is just Aristotelian teaching. It has no experimentation. It has no empiricism, as we would call it, in it. So you can lay some of the credit at the door of universities, but I wouldn't lay it all there.
Maybe in the beginning and then developing all through the centuries up until, as you say, Isaac Newton and Francis Bacon and so forth. Let's also just touch upon Jews and Judaism and science and history, because you've written a little part part of that is also contained in your book. So what do they bring into this, the Jews?
My chapter on science in medieval Judaism is called Ambiguous and Argumentative. And I think they're the two things that they bring. You have to remember that Jewish thinkers are on the periphery of the mainstream of European thought for a very long time. They are socially, politically very vulnerable. That gives them certain advantages and certain disadvantages. They're not constrained by any received wisdom, if you like, but at the same time, there is a risk at thinking things that might further undermine their already vulnerable social position. On top of this, there is already a deep tradition in Jewish thought of argument. There are plenty of examples in the Talmud of quoting Rabbi A says this, and Rabbi B says this, and Rabbi C says this. So there is a very rich argumentative strand which feeds into the Jewish thought of the natural world in the Middle Ages, and an ambiguity to it too. There is less of a need to settle an argument and a greater willingness to keep different strands of argument going. Of course, there are changes there. And when Maimonides, who is by far and away the most influential Jewish thinker and scientist and philosopher at the time, he comes to certain conclusions, and that elicits a backlash from some more nervous Jewish thinkers. But there is, a liveliness to Jewish thought, which enables a kind of a fruitful reflection on the natural world at that time. But we'll have to remember, again, you're talking about a very small minority of people who are in a socially very vulnerable position. So they're unlikely to be, as it were, leading the charge here.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn to a century or a period which is really both fascinating and important in this story, because we tend to think that religion was left out with the scientific revolution. Scientific revolution, you could date that, and later with the Enlightenment. So obviously this comes before what we call the Enlightenment, especially in France. But your account shows that this is all wrong. So we can go into details around people like Galileo, Copernicus, Bacon, and later Descartes and the Enlightenment. So some of those figures, you write extensively about them, but we might take some of the main points from them and say something about what happens between science and religion in this very important period.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's so much there. I'll try and be as brief as I can. Again, one has to guard against there being such a thing as science and such a thing as religion in the 16th century. They're not.
Yes, of course.
They're twins. Which means that pretty much nobody sees themselves as doing science, which is in any way anti-religious. The idea put about by Freud and others that the Copernican decentering of the earth somehow decentered humans and also the Christian worldview is just simply not true. And the tension such as there was around Copernicanism tended to come in the first instance from Protestants who quoted some verses from the Old Testament and thought they were incompatible with a heliocentric world. But actually, Copernicus's De Revolutionibus Unibus was not read by very many people at all for most of the 16th century. It becomes more established, obviously, through Galileo in the 17th century. I've got a whole chapter in Galileo because he is used as the icon of the tension between science and religion. There was undoubtedly tension there. What, you know, people know about the story about him appearing for the Inquisition and being prohibited from teaching heliocentrism is true, but there are plenty of wheels within wheels there, not least Galileo himself, who had this unique ability to lose friends and alienate people. And the Galileo affair was a disaster that never needed to happen, really. It is then picked up by Protestant thinkers in Northwest Europe, who then use the Galileo story as a way of bashing the Catholic Church on their head and say, this is why you need to be a Protestant, because we value freedom of thought and conscience, unlike those Catholics who try to shut Galileo up. And the irony is, then 100 or so years later, Enlightenment thinkers pick up this Protestant rhetorical device against Galileo and then use it against Christianity as a whole. And so Galileo becomes the icon of resistance, not just to the Catholic Church or the Inquisition, but to Christianity and to Christian obscurantism altogether. So there are lots of political and theological and ecclesiological currents beneath the superficial stories of what's happening with Copernicus or what's happening with Galileo.
Mm. Because people use these stories or even invent them proper, or take out quotes from people and using it, just as you say, politically and to try to make their points. So that's really interesting, because if you just read stories like you, as I said to you, the interesting thing about your book is those details, because it tells that this picture is much more nuanced and complicated than it kind of seems if you just think that Galileo was the one or Copernicus was the one that turned just suddenly told us that the earth was round and was going around the sun instead of, I think, well, as you say, that has been, it's not new. It's not something that he just invented, but he became the figure of it. So, and then later Descartes and the Enlightenment, and are there people in the later after Galileo that you would like to point to?
I mean, there are loads, but there's an example I pick up from the 18th century, which I think is quite interesting, in a chapter called Mechanizing the Soul. There is an English doctor, I suppose, called David Hartley, who puts forward an idea that humans are just material creatures and that the emotions that we feel, sensations, or even the values and virtues we practice are material. Now, on the surface of it, that's exactly the kind of thing that seemed to be a scientific battering ram against religion. But the interesting thing was that David Hartley was a thoroughly pious Christian Englishman. He wasn't using his science as a way of attacking religion. He was simply saying that, as it were, matter is the medium for God's meaning, if I can put it that way. So that humans exist as material beings. God is incarnated amongst them. God creates the material world. He operates through matter. There's no opposition between saying happiness or sadness or goodness are material things because it's a material world that God has created. In other words, he's speaking against what's known as substance dualism. Now, there's a Frenchman at the time, a French doctor at roughly the same time called Julien Lemaître in France, who makes more or less the same argument. But Maître is the atheist's atheist. He is, there are a number of atheists in France in the 18th century, but he is so scandalous and so blunt and unapologetic about atheism that he makes the other atheists feel nervous. And he is using his science, his medical science, as a battering ram against Christianity. So you have this weird thing about two people who are arguing quite similar things, but come to very different religious conclusions. And that's partly because that's what happens a lot of the time with science. The science doesn't dictate the metaphysical or the religious conclusion you come to. But it's also happening because the culture in which they took each of them operated was very different. And there was a greater level of intellectual generosity and breadth in Britain at the time, which meant that David Hartley could make his case, and it might upset a few bishops, but it wouldn't be too much of a problem. Whereas Lemaître lived a peripatetic life because he could never settle down. He had to publish anonymously, as many of the French philosophers had to. Some of them couldn't even publish at all because at the very least the authorities would burn his books and they may well burn him as well. And so when you're in that kind of ecclesiastically backed, intellectually oppressive atmosphere, there's all the more reason to use your science as a way of attacking the religion. Whereas in Britain, you didn't have to. It's an example of that classic thing that if an intellectual system doesn't bend, ultimately it breaks. And in Britain, it bent a lot in the 18th century. In France, it didn't. And famously, it ended up breaking in the 1790s.
Yes, and as you say, we could also include probably the Netherlands because people went there as well, and for the obviously the same reasons as they went to Britain, of course.
So even more so, actually, yes.
Even more so, yeah. We could just jump into the 19th century because we started the conversation about religion, science with the 19th century. You had the story from the 19th century, and you quote in your book, and that's, I guess, the origin of the title of your book, Magisteria, that the American evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, properly speaking, science and religion, where no non-overlapping magisteria. You quote it and you say it's probably he's just saying the opposite of what you are trying to explain in your book. So why did you what are the main reasons, I think, for science and religion to become opposites, and then also, of course, clearer in what they mean, as we just said when you were trying to explain these terms? They were intertwined before that, but then they became two different things. So let's jump into the 19th century.
I'm loath to give Stephen Jay Gould a kicking because he wrote so winsomely, and his idea of non-overlapping magisteria is born of good intention. Really, he's trying to effect a ceasefire in a rather stupidly acrimonious war between creationists and evolutionists in late 20th century America. But he did so at the case of effectively defining religion as one thing and defining science as another thing, and then saying they don't mix. Now, historically, as we've been talking about, that transparently isn't the case. I mean, they were pretty much the same activity once upon a time. But even in the modern world, that's not the case, because you can't separate facts and values in that way. Now, let's give him credit where it's due. There are lots of ways in which science and religion do not indeed overlap. As it happens, he borrowed the term magisteria from Catholic teaching as a kind of an authoritative body of teaching. So there are lots of ways in which science is an authoritative body of practice and teaching, and religion is as well, and they don't overlap. Religion has nothing whatsoever to say about the composition of the periodic table, for example. Science, as we understand it, doesn't have much to say about the meanings of Jesus's parables, for example. However, you can't separate the two quite as easily as that. And in particular, my argument is that there is one entity in this world in which they very visibly, regularly overlap, and that's us. That's human beings. And this goes back to my initial point, is there are lots of different ways of understanding a human being. I could understand you as a survival machine, Mathilde, or a reproduction machine, or a bunch of cells, or organs, or an immune system, et cetera, et cetera. And they would all be accurate description. I would be understanding you in the third person as an it, as an object, and they would all be accurate. However, if that's all I ever did about you, you wouldn't feel very understood. You would feel as if I was a doctor, effectively, and I was understanding you as a body, as an organism. Human beings are that, but they are more than that. And this is where you shift into the language of the soul. Now, I'm not a substance dualist. I don't believe in the soul as a kind of a free-floating thing. But it's just the language we use to describe me as an I, as a kind of person who is not only exists in, but is fulfilled by profound interpersonal relationships, and also has deep desires and a sense of purpose and a malleable, complex sense of identity and a thirst for destiny. And often, very commonly amongst human beings, a desire for the transcendent, which we experience momentarily through beauty and music and so on and so forth. That is understanding you, not as an alternative to you as a material being, but to you as what we might call a personal or a spiritual being. And the tensions have really arisen when one side or the other have said, no, this is the only way to understand Mathilde. You can only understand her in this way. Whereas, properly speaking, I think a full, rich, and rewarding understanding of a person will incorporate both their material existence, but also their spiritual personal existence. And one other thing, this is, I think, what's most interesting, and where the touch paper has always been in the science and religion debate, because if you're honest about it, science cannot prove or disprove the existence of God. What it can do, though, is say you are or are not the kind of being that is envisaged in the world religions. And if science says you are not the kind of being that is envisaged in the world religions, as some people thought it was doing in the 19th century, that's the point when religious believers go, oh my goodness, I don't like this.
So, yeah, and of course, you spent, as you told us in the beginning here, an ample number of pages on Darwin and all that happened around him. And you also mentioned another thinker who wrote something 30 years before. But let's go to Darwin, and let's go to the essence of this debate, because in a way, it seems like religion at this point is kind of losing, as we talked about initially, the authority of defining what it is. It was like suddenly there was something else on the other side saying that, as you just explained, this is the human being. And then, as you also say, since we cannot find the soul, it's nowhere to be found. If you look into a human being, it's nowhere. It's as you just said, cells or material things, biology, but it's but and then it kind of for religion in some ways feels that okay, oh, what are we going to do now? We can't find this soul. Is a human being just biology, and how can we counter that? And I guess that's some of the things that are happening in the debates that Darwin or his colleagues and people around him that was kind of the core of those debates in the 19th century. But you can explain what you found out.
Yes, you've done a very good job there, really. There are so many different things going on in the Darwinian discussions and debates in the second half of the 19th century. Now, at the most superficial level, there are people who think the world is 6,000 years old and don't like the idea that it's millions of years old. Although actually that fight had begun many years before Darwin with the geologists. There are those who don't like the idea, and still don't, as we famously know, that human beings are descended from, or in parallel with other primates, and descended from earlier primates, because somehow or other they think that reduces our dignity. That was a very big issue, say, at the big Oxford debate in 1860 between Wilberforce and Huxley. There are others who are anxious that the scientific seeming ability to understand humans comprehensively would preclude any religious understanding of the human. This is what we were talking about earlier. They don't necessarily have a qualm about Genesis or Adam and Eve or anything like that. But what they do worry about is that if human beings are only evolved creatures, what else is left of us? And then there are other issues around the authority of natural philosophers, who are very often Anglican clerics, being usurped by more secular scientists. And even beyond all that, this happens to be the same period of time when what was known as German higher criticism is invading the popular mind, which treats the scriptures as a historical text to understand through historical means, which was very threatening to many Protestants. Far more controversial than Darwin's Origin of Species, with a book published 9 months later called Essays and Reviews in England, which was the first major incursion of German higher criticism into the academy. And the seven authors of that were highly controversial figures. But basically that meant that religious believers felt they were being attacked on all sides, attacked by the biblical interpreters, attacked by the scientists, and they got very, very defensive. So there are lots of things going on there. But it is worth saying that, in the words of James Moore, who's a historian who wrote a book on the post-Darwinian controversies, it is very interesting that within a generation, this has settled down. Darwin was buried in Westminster Abbey in 1882. They didn't do that to heretics. And so there was a lot of noise at first, but it wasn't a particularly long-lasting storm.
So if we go into this century then, and people will recognize that we say that societies have become very secular, and in that sense, secular as the opposite of religious. So, but we see that religion, it hasn't disappeared. On the contrary, it's still there with us. How do you explain this if we put this into this story that you have, we are kind of putting this into this picture? So religion is there, and even though people say that they don't believe in evolution, and they don't believe that we are descendant from the apes or whatever, and especially you are writing about what's happening in the United States. You mentioned creationism, you mentioned the controversies that Jay Gould was talking about. So how is this picture developed through our century?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that people do not lose their faith because of science, or only a tiny minority do. That used to be the argument. It really isn't the case. It's empirically, it has been shown not to be the case. People did not lose their faith in the 19th and 20th centuries because of the incursion of science, and they're not going to in the future. So in a sense, there's nothing to explain there. Different countries have become more secular, more non-religious, sometimes more anti-religious for quite specific reasons. Those reasons are almost always political and social and cultural. Science feeds into that, but we're looking at the wrong thing altogether. If we're searching for science as the root of secularization, it doesn't work like that.
So, but then again, as you say, why do people not believe in science then when that's the, well, if I can say that's the case in the United States, for instance?
Well, again, we'll have to be slightly careful here. There's a very good American professor who has done a great deal of research in this area called Elaine Howard Eklund, who has looked into considerable detail on the nature of American religious, in particular evangelical, understanding of an attitude to science. It is not the case that evangelicals reject science altogether at all. It is the case that there are several stumbling blocks that religious believers in the US in particular and evangelicals have with specific elements of science and in particular evolution. Elaine's argument is that their main objections are that if they believe science is saying that God cannot intervene, they choose their religion over their science. If they believe that science is saying that humans are only evolved creatures with no soul, no eternal destiny, etc., they choose their religion over their science. Now, that is, I think, to my mind, a slightly overly neat way of putting it, and there certainly is a more inchoate rejection of certain scientific doctrines, particularly evolution, amongst American fundamentalists. And I have to remember that America is caught up in this maelstrom of a culture war where anything can pretty much be blamed on anything else. And the old adage that was put about during the Scopes monkey trial in the 1920s, that if you tell children they're descended from apes, they'll behave like little monkeys, still is prevalent in many quarters today. But it is not a wholesale American religious rejection of science altogether. It is more, as it were, specific points of tension and rejection in a very big and complex picture.
Before we end here, we'll go into something that's on many people's lips right now. And before I mention what that is, you have to explain to us why you mentioned the Turing test and why it's become popular to quote, because that has something to do about the question of what it is to be human.
So the Turing test, as it came to be known originally, the imitation game, was way of the brilliant wartime British mathematician Alan Turing to answer the question, can a machine think? And he said in this test, that's too vague. You need to be more precise. And the way you're more precise is that you play a game where you have, it's a variation of a party game where you have two people behind a closed door. You pass them questions, they write answers back, and you've got to tell which of your friends it is. And he said, well, you have one person, then you have a machine there. And you eradicate all potentially revealing signs, voice or, you know, handwriting or anything. You put type questions at the door, you get type questions back. And if you cannot tell who or what is behind which door, you can justifiably argue that the machine is thinking. In other words, if you cannot tell that machine's answers are the machine's answers as opposed to human's answers, they are, for all intents and purposes, as good as a human answer, and therefore you could say a machine is thinking. That's the Turing test.
And you quote it because as you end your way, ending your book now in 2023, and the next step in history of religion, science is about to embark, because we have something called artificial intelligence. And especially after the launch of the ChatGPT and all kinds of things that are coming like a flow of new possibilities. And that, of course, comes back to the Turing test and comes back to what intelligence is, and what if that is the thing that makes us particular, well, humans, and if other entities like a machine could do and could think the same way we do, then we won't be we will have competition in a way. We have there are many thoughts that could be, or many things that could be said. But what are your thoughts on artificial intelligence and these things when it comes to the things that you've been writing about?
Well, the first thing I should say is that even though I conclude this book on that subject, I've got a book coming out next year, which, as it were, takes the story forward.
We'll have to talk then, of course.
So that's called playing God, and that picks up 8 different areas, all focusing on main point of magisteria, which is that it's at this point of the question of the human that science and religion is most interesting. Now, you mentioned AI. There are lots of other interesting ones. There's the issue of animal personhood, whether we should recognize the rights of chimpanzees, gorillas, dolphins, elephants, that kind of thing. There's the issue of extreme longevity, the fact that the Silicon Valley billionaires are pouring huge amounts of money into the idea of helping us live until we're 200 or longer. There's the idea of genetic manipulation and how far should we be able to design and redesign one another and our children. And, of course, there's the idea of AI. And all of these questions gravitate towards the meta question of what is a human? And AI is a classic one of those, the one that's getting most airtime. Without spoiling my argument from next year, I think that we are really asking the wrong questions when it comes to the question of the status of AI, and that the real issue is the question of the body, not of the mind, but of the body. And we do it because we see ourselves as different from other animals because we are more intelligent than other animals. Therefore, we see intelligence as the quintessential human characteristic. And therefore, if something comes along, which is, and we redefine intelligence as processing power, and then something comes along which has in rather greater processing power than we do the math and we work out that they've got greater processing power, therefore they're more intelligent, therefore they're more human, and therefore they're going to be our kind of robot overlords. I don't think that's right, or rather I think that particular kind of, there's a logic to that chain of arguments, but it overlooks the point that actually over and above our intelligence is the fact that we are bodily creatures. We are contingent, vulnerable, temporal bodily creatures that seek goods, avoid bads, and have a situatedness, a position in the world, which means that we act in certain ways. At the moment, no AI in the world is close to that. At some point in the future, I'm not against the idea of AI developing a soul, in inverted commas, but I think the litmus test for doing so is not to ask how intelligent it is or how quickly it processes or stores information. It's to ask, where is it? Physically, where is it? Does it have to search for its own nutrients? Does it have to dispose of its own waste? Does it have to form relationships to keep it going? As soon as it has that situated, vulnerable, bodily existence in reality, then I think we can start asking the question about whether it has a soul or not.
I was thinking about continuing this in question here about artificial intelligence and so forth, but I think we'll just leave it like that because, as you said, you're writing a book about it, and I think it will be a pleasure to read that as well when time comes. So I'd rather say I invite you back.
I'd love to come back.
So for the time, I'll just say thank you for joining me today, Nick. It's been a pleasure to talking to you today.
And a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
And Nick's book is, of course, available in bookstores and online. And as you've probably understood, I highly recommend it. And I also, of course, recommend Liberal Halvtimme. Rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtimme, en podcast fra Tankesmien Civita.